Guys, oh boy, fasten your seatbelts. Today, people say that I'm the Lebanese honey badger, but I think the real Lebanese honey badger is here with us. Brigitte Gabriel, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
I'm so glad that we finally connected. I'm going to read your bio, then we're going to do a little bit of niceties in Arabic, and then we will jump straight down. Let me first tell people who you are. You're a national security analyst, a New York Times bestselling author, and chairman of ActForAmerica.org. Your latest bestseller is Rise in Defense of Judeo-Christian Values and Freedom. Two earlier books, both of which were also very successful, Because They Hate, A Survivor of Islamic Terror Warns America, warnings 20 years ago. And then They Must Be Defeated, Why We Must Defeat Radical Islam and How We Can Do It. Did I cover the key points?
Yes, you did.
اوكي خليني اول شيء اقول لك انه كثير مبسوط انه عم بتعرف عليك اليوم. كيف صحتك؟
Oh my God, ما تتصدق انا قد ايه مبسوطه لانه معك وعم بحكي عربي. انت اول انترفيو انا بعطيها وبحكي مع حدا عربي. It's amazing.
فظيع فظيع. I just said that I'm so excited to be meeting you and that we just want to say a couple of things in Arabic, and she said this is we're breaking new grounds here, guys. First time ever that she breaks out the beautiful Arabic. One quick accent issue. How do you say room in your accent?
Uda.
See, we
What do you
say,
mean, room? Room like Uda?
yeah. You say, I was hoping you'd say that because that's a Christian dialect. We say,
Yes.
Oda. How do you say, I want to eat?
Badi akel.
Biddi akol, we say, biddi akol. So,
Ah, you have the Palestinian
exactly. I'm the real
language.
Palestinian, Brigitte.
That's right. You have the Palestinian accent.
مظبوط.
I have the Lebanese accent. Lebanese قح. مثل ما بنقولها بالعربي as we say
مظبوط.
it in Arabic.
مظبوط. Okay, so let's start. Your personal story is an incredible one. Many people know it, but others don't. Please walk us through your history in Lebanon and then leaving Lebanon.
Well, actually, what I want to start with, how amazing it is to be with you as a Jewish Lebanese. Most people don't even think or know that Jews lived in Lebanon as Lebanese. When they think of Jews, people forgot about the Jews who lived in Arabic countries or Arabic speaking countries. Because, you know, we in Lebanon, we're not Arabs, we're Arab phones. Okay, I want to make sure we clarify that. But a lot of people do not talk about the Jewish people who were kicked out of Arabic countries, who are no longer living in the areas where they were born, in the homes where they built through their fathers and their grandparents, etc., because they became refugees. They were kicked out of their Arabic countries. And, you know, they cannot go back. The majority of them, over 1 million Jews from Arab land, are refugees who are accepted by the state of Israel. You don't hear about them because obviously Israel absorbed them. They have a life there. So they're not screaming about, we want to go back to our land. They accepted, okay, we'll go to the Jewish state and we live there. The reason why I bring this point up, God, is because when you look at the Palestinian issue right now, none of the Arabic countries want them. They do not want them to come. They do not want them to have a life there. And this is exactly why we are seeing this problem like cancer mushroom, you know, never treated. And so, you know, it's amazing to be with you as a Jewish Lebanese. And here I am, a Christian Lebanese. We both speak the same language, pretty much, with the exception of a little difference in the dialect. We probably eat the same food. We both love belly dancing.
And
We
we
both
both
love
love
open mics.
Fairuz.
And we both love Fairuz, exactly.
You know,
So,
I used to, this is several years ago, whenever I would bring on a Arabic speaking guest, I would joke with them and say, I'm going to sing you a song in Arabic. If you guess who it is, then this guarantees me that you are not an Israeli spy. If you don't guess who it is, then you are Jasus Israeli. And usually they get, my singing ability is restricted to Fairuz. So it was, I would just go through the different songs of Fairuz with the different guests.
Wow. Yeah, she's an icon. Icon all over the Middle East.
She's still alive?
She's still alive. She's in her 80s. I still check on the Lebanese news. I go to my Facebook and, nostalgia because I cannot go back to Lebanon. Hezbollah wants my head on a platter. Because, we have an occupied country right now by a terrorist regime, a terrorist organization funded by Iran. Hezbollah, the only difference is they carry Lebanese passports. Well, probably, I do not know if you still carry a Lebanese passport, but I can't get a
I
Lebanese
don't.
passport. Yeah, and I don't want to. But in any way, the nostalgia, I still think about Lebanon. I miss Lebanon. I miss the food. So I go back on Lebanese different websites and I listen to the music. And it's amazing, when you grew up in a certain way, like today when I'm sipping my coffee in the morning, I'm listening to Fairuz in the morning, Fairuziyat, and I listen to all my Arabic music. It's who I am. It made me who I am today. Those first 18 years of your life determine who you're going to be and what makes you for the rest of your life. And
Very
I'm
true.
grateful I was raised in a great culture that respects people, respects diversity, that it's an inclusive culture. Unfortunately, that's all on our side, the Jewish Christian side, because we want to get along with everybody. And the Muslims don't exactly share our feelings.
Do you, I want you to go through all of your personal history in a second, but since we're jumping ahead now, do you think there is ever a hope, inshallah, in our lifetimes that you and I would ever be able to take our family and go back, if only to visit, or do you think that window closed long time ago?
I don't see any hope right now in us going back and visiting. I remember taking my children to Israel in 2018, and I wanted to see Lebanon. And I remember going up to Misgav Am in Israel on the border with Lebanon. And I remember my children and I and my son-in-law are looking through the binocular. And I'm pointing Marjayun to them. This is my town. This is where I was raised. I'm looking through the binocular. This is where my home used to be. This is the school that my father built that my children will never lay eyes on. And that's why I tell people all the time when I'm speaking, when I'm fundraising, when I am talking about why we need to preserve our civilization, I tell people, what good is it to create wealth if you cannot leave your children a country in which they can live?
Yeah, very
My
true.
children will never, ever lay eyes on what their grandparents, my mom and my dad, have built or contributed to or supported or nothing. My children will never see my father's name, their grandfather's name on any hospital or in any school or in any church or on anything. We can't go back
Yeah,
until we defeat Hezbollah and Iran.
very true. One of my only regrets so far as a parent is that I haven't inculcated our children with the richness of our heritage. So I also speak. Do you speak Hebrew? Very nice. I speak, of course, Arabic, Hebrew, French, and English. French, again, because we grew up in Lebanon, which
Same
at one
here,
point was,
yeah.
right? And my wife also, she's Lebanese Armenian, so she speaks Armenian. So between the two of us, we speak five languages. But the problem was, Brigitte, that if I spoke to them in Arabic or Hebrew, my wife would be out of the game because she doesn't speak Arabic because she came too early to Montreal. If she speaks in Armenian, I don't understand. So we ended up settling on only French and English. And I so regret that my children can't just come to your house and speak to you in Arabic, because frankly, even though I'm Jewish, to your earlier point, my culture is Arabic. I speak Arabic, I listen to Arabic music, I eat Arabic food, but people don't appreciate that you could be Christian, you could be Jewish, and be fully Arabic in your ethnicity and orientation.
Exactly. Look, we appreciate the best of the culture in which we were raised. I love Middle Eastern music. I love belly dancing. This is how I exercise. I belly dance. I don't do yoga. I don't do aerobics. That's my form of exercising. When I listen to music in my home, that's what I listen to. The food that I cook, I make all the traditional Lebanese food in my home. But I agree with you because when my children were growing up, Even though they ate the Lebanese food, you know, they're used to wine. I would make them the stuffed grape leaves,
Right.
the stuffed kousa, you know, and all these traditional food, the mjadara, etc. And they would say to me, "Why can't we eat, you know, macaroni and cheese like normal people food?" You know, and here I stood 3 hours cooking and stuffing grape leaves and rolling grape leaves or making baklava or tabbouleh and all of that stuff. And but finally, now that they are adults, they gravitated back to those memories growing up with mommy in the kitchen, dicing the parsley, making the tabbouleh. Now they look at it, now they adopted that culture. I don't regret not teaching them Arabic, and here is why. As a woman, I will never regret growing up in Lebanon. And you know, in Lebanon, you're familiar with the phrase, Allah yustir alayki. Allah yustir alayki ba'aris, when we would serve the coffee, meaning may God cover your shame with a husband. Because as a single woman, when you're not married, you are ashamed just to exist unless you are married. And I told my children, because they would ask me, how come you're not teaching us Arabic? And I said, I never ever want you to go, I don't want you to even understand that statement, if anybody
Right.
ever said it to you, because I don't want your ears being soiled by such language. And so
Wow.
I don't regret not teaching them Arabic. As a woman, I'm very independent. I'm a feminist. But they got all the other good stuff.
Very nice. Okay, so give us a brief summary of your harrowing. I mean, I've got my own harrowing story trying to escape Lebanon, but I think yours is certainly as difficult. Give us a brief synopsis, and then we can drill down into some of the current realities that we're facing in the West.
Oh God. Well, my story is pretty much the story of a lot of Christian Lebanese. You know, I was born into the country that used to be Paris of the Middle East, the banking capital of the Middle East. Between 1965 and 1975, Beirut and Lebanon were experiencing an amazing economic boom, explosion, tourists from all over the world coming to vacation in Lebanon. We were open-minded, we were fair, we were tolerant, we were multicultural. We had open borders. We welcomed everyone from the surrounding Arabic countries who wanted to come and study in our universities, because we had built the best universities in the Middle East, as you know.
Of course.
Muslims send their children from all over the Islamic world. They graduated and worked in our economy because we had built the best economy in the Middle East, even though we did not have any oil. Unfortunately, all that began to change as we imported people into our country who did not share our values. And what I mean by that is we imported Palestinian refugees who came to our country. Lebanon was the only country in the Arabic world to accept the third wave of Palestinian refugees. After King Hussein kicked them out of Jordan, they came to Lebanon. They put their heads together with the Muslims in Lebanon. And they declared war on the Christians. They wanted to create a base from which to fight Israel, kill the Jews, and throw them into the sea, something they tried to do in Jordan, but they failed because of the dictatorship of King Hussein. But they were able to use Lebanese democracy to topple our democracy. And that's when the war started. I come from southern Lebanon in a little town called Marjayoun on the border with Israel, Marjayoun. You know, we were a small Christian town on the border, and the Palestinians had formed Jaish Libnan al-Arabi, the Arabic Lebanese army. They started with the Muslims at that time, led by Ahmed al-Khatib, who was the guy who headed it. And they started splitting the army, so, and taking over military bases. Well, I lived about 50 yards below the military base in Marjayoun. As the Palestinian tried to shell the military base to take it over, 14 shells exploded in my home, falling short of the military base, bringing my home down and burying me under the rubble wounded. I ended up in the hospital for 2.5 months and later ended up living in a bomb shelter underground. It was like an 8 by 10 room, no electricity, no water, very little food, because the Palestinians and the Islamists surrounded us and cut off the electricity, cut off water supply to our town, cut off food supplies. But thankfully, we lived in the mountains, so we had Marjayoun was called Valley of Spring, Merjel Uyun. That's where it gets its name. We had seven springs in our town. And that became my existence. And that's where I lived in that bomb shelter for 7 years of my life, robbed of my youth.
Wow. And then after you were able to leave, you left to Israel, correct?
Correct.
And how many years did you spend in Israel?
I lived in Israel from 1984 till 1989. I became news anchor for World News in the Middle East, based out of Jerusalem, Israel.
Wow. And did you, so prior to going to Israel, because yes, of course, there's a lot of anti-Semitism that comes from the Islamic community, but in all fairness, we also know that many Christian Arabs don't hold the most warm feelings towards the Jews. So as you made your way to Israel, were you inculcated with some of those nasty feelings about the Jews and then were surprised by it? Or in your own upbringing, you had never experienced the typical Jew hatred that you see in the Middle East?
I never experienced the Jew hatred personally in my home. Remember, the war broke out, I was 10 years old, and then we were cut off from the rest of Lebanon. So my parents never really hated anybody. They were church going, they always, you hear it on the news, Lebanese news, Israel, Azrael, which is the name of Satan. They would be playing how the Palestinian refugees, the poor Palestinians, are coming to Lebanon. We're taking them in. So these were the official talking points of the Lebanese government, because they control Lebanese television. But in my home, I never heard anything like that. When the war broke out, Israel was our only lifeline. Because I look, God, when we were in the bomb shelter, and we as the Christians, we were surrounded to be slaughtered by the Muslims and the Palestinians. And I remember one night, I think I was around 13 years old, one of our militia men stopped by and he said, "Brigitte, I just want you to know that we are surrounded to be slaughtered tonight. We heard a lot of chatter on the radio, and I don't think we're going to last because we lost a lot of men. We don't have enough to defend the town." And he said, "If I don't see you tomorrow, I wish you a merciful death." And he gave me a hug and left.
Wow.
And I remember at the age of 13, dressing in my Sunday best, my Easter dress, because I wanted to look pretty when I am dead, knowing that when they come to slaughter me, there would be no one to bury me. And I remember begging my mother, "I don't want to die. I'm only 13 years old. Please do something." And there was nothing my mother could say to me. And I remember sitting in the corner of our bomb shelter, and my father opened up the Bible and started reading from Psalms. "I shall walk into the valley of death and fear no evil, for thou art with me." And my parents said to me, "When they come to slaughter us tonight, we will create a distraction. We just want you to run towards the Israeli border and don't look back." See, we knew, we lived 5 kilometers from the Israeli border, and we knew if we run to the Jews and beg for help, the Jews are not going to slaughter us because we had more shared values with them than we had with the Muslims. And thank God I didn't have to make that decision that night, because that's the night when Israel came in physically into Lebanon in 1978 and set up artillery bases around the hills surrounding our town to protect us and created the security zone. And that's how we lived until 1984, when Israel invaded Lebanon, working with the Christians, trying to help the Christians take back their democracy and kick out the radical Islamic element that had taken control of the country at that time. Because by the time Israel entered Lebanon in 1982, we had 11 Islamic terrorist organizations operating out of Lebanon, including the PLO. So while I was growing up in the bomb shelter as a teenager, my only knowledge of the world, of any friend we ever had or anybody that cared about us, was Israel, not Lebanon. The Lebanese government didn't care about us. The rest of the world forgot about us. I remember my father in the beginning of the war, and he would say, "France is going to come see what's happening to the Christians in Lebanon because of all the Palestinian massacres against the Christians." My daddy would say, "France is going to come." And nobody came. America's going to come. Canada's going to come. Australia's going to come. And the world forgot about us. So growing up as a Christian girl in southern Lebanon, the only friend I knew growing up at 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 were the Israeli people, Israel. And so when I moved, and of course, my mother was wounded in the war, we ended up spending 22 days in the hospital in Israel. Actually, my life story is detailed in my first book titled Because They Hate. I encourage people to get it. It's a New York Times bestseller. The book sold over 1 million copies,
Wow.
and it's an amazing story. So I encourage people, read the story, and because they hate. And so, well, my mother was wounded in the war. We ended up in Israel. And those 22 days when I was 17 years old, spending it in Israel changed my life. That's when I made a decision that I will go back to Israel no matter what happens, no matter the cost, no matter what I have to do. I had one goal, and that is to go back to Israel and from Israel come to the United States. And I ended up moving to Israel in 1984. And that's when I really developed my love for Israel, my loyalty to Israel, my adaptation of Israeli culture, my appreciation and deep understanding of the Jewish state. Look, in Israel, you ride the bus, you hear 32 languages on the bus. Every two people are speaking a different language. I lived in Jerusalem, the most cosmopolitan city in the world. The culture, the art, the languages, the intellect, it was amazing. And I knew in Lebanon, this did not exist in Lebanon. I mean, Israel was on a whole different level. And as a Lebanese and as a citizen of the world, because I learned to appreciate, good traits, good character, good values, and be able to start, when you're 20, 21, 22, you're starting to compare. You're starting to make up your mind as a young adult when you learn about the world and you see it through the lens of a young adult trying to make up your mind. You learn, you start seeing a difference. You may not know the word for it, but you start seeing a major difference and contrast between the two cultures. And that's when I developed my true love and appreciation for Israel and Israelis.
So how do you, I mean, I know you've been doing this for many years now, trying to warn people as I have. How frustrating must it be for you? I mean, for both of us, Mjerbin, right? We've tried it, we've been there. Listen to us, we know what we're talking about. To see the West so outlandishly clueless in their immigration policies, in their foreign policy. I mean, it's literally as though every single thing that the West does is the perfectly incorrect thing. Do you see any possibility to wake our leaders up, or are we in a death spiral that we're never going to get out of?
Our, unfortunately, they say there's nothing new under the sun, and history always repeats itself. And they say those who are doomed from learning from history are doomed to repeat. Those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And so today, you and I are speaking to each other in 2024 in the West, and we are seeing the same signs of the Holocaust. What people thought it will never, ever happen again. We are seeing the same signs now play out on the streets of Canada, Australia, America, worldwide. I remember speaking when I first started speaking out after 9/11. I was at a Jewish home. They were having a parlor meeting for me about the work that I was doing. And in the audience was a Holocaust survivor. This was 2004. And I remember talking about the signs. We're seeing the signs because I started a grassroots organization and I would travel and I would speak to different people all over America. And I started seeing the signs in different communities. And I said, this is what you have to be careful of. This is what's happening. And that Holocaust survivor stood up and left so angry at me because she did not want to believe that what I was saying was the truth. And she tried to shoot down every single logical explanation I tried to put out as to why we need to organize now and why we need to be careful. 2004, 20 years ago. And so the reason why history repeats itself is because people, for whatever reason, do not want to believe that can happen again because every generation thinks, no, our generation is different. Look at teenagers and the youth. Every generation thinks, oh, we are so different than anybody that has ever came before us. We're college kids, we're going to change the world. We're all going to have kumbaya. We're all going to live peacefully together. Everybody's going to get along, and we're going to change the whole world, and it's going to be amazing. Every college graduate thought the same thing. And then, as you go through life and reality hits, and you realize there's nothing new under the sun, people are people. And from the beginning of ages, when you look through the theme, through humanity from the beginning, jealousy, hatred, love, sex, betrayal. It's all the same thing. I mean, we're not doing anything new in the 21st century than what people did back 2,000 years ago. Except today, people are not waking up. And the reason why today we are not learning, especially those of us who come from Judeo-Christian worldview, is we are reflecting our values on evil people. We, just because you and I are not going to send our children to die and strap bombs on their bodies and then rejoice in their death and hand out candy, we cannot fathom that a mother or a father could be so happy that their child died. And I think that's the problem. That's why in the West, they are refusing to understand how can the Palestinians, the Islamists, because I'm going to say Islamists, whether you are a Palestinian, whether you are a Somali who belong to Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, it doesn't matter what society, what language you speak, what passport you hold, the common denominator between all these terrorist groups who are willing to sacrifice their own children is the Islamic ideology. And we, people who come from a Judeo-Christian worldview, do not want to accept that there is a segment in that ideology that actually commands their people to do that.
Well, I actually, there's a clip that has gone viral all over the internet from about 7, 8 years ago. I had appeared on Dave Rubin's show, and I know that you also know Dave, and where I was trying to explain the quote distinction between Islam and Islamism. And I was explaining that Islamism is a large inherent part of Islam. It's not something that's outside of it. 90% of Islam is political Islam. Yes, there are spiritual elements, but those spiritual elements are dwarfed by the political ideology within Islam. That's why I don't like, for example, the terms, I know you used it in one of your books, radical Islam or militant Islam or extremist Islam or Islamism. All those qualifiers for me are nonsensical. Islam is Islam. There are nice Muslims who decide to ignore most of the stuff, just like there are nice Jews and nice Christians and mean Jews and mean Christians. But itself, the ideology of Islam is perfectly manufactured to be antithetical to Western values. Is there any hope that we can ever get people to understand that?
You're going to get some people to understand that. And I think with ISIS, a lot of people started opening their eyes and saying, why do they believe the same that they believe? Why do they carry a flag that says, La ilaha illallah Muhammadun Rasulullah? There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, which is the same words on the flag of Saudi Arabia, for example. The only difference is one green and one is black. And people shy away from confront. People don't like confrontation,
Yes.
and people shy away from confronting difficult decisions. And look, you and I grew up in what in any culture, people tell you two things you don't discuss at the dinner table: religion and politics. And what is Islam? It's a political ideology cloaked in religion.
Nice.
So we in the West avoid talking about this. And in my books, I talk about that, especially in my second book, They Must Be Stopped is the title. Why We Must Defeat Radical Islam and How We Can Do It. And I talk in particular about a study that the Pentagon did where they assigned a special unit to understand why, very highly educated young men and in some cases young women are willing to blow themselves up to smithereen. Where did this ideology come from? And when the Pentagon, they studied it for 6 months, and finally the unit issued a report. The media ignored it as if it was nuclear and harmful to your health. And here's why. Because it pointed to one thing. It's the religion itself. It's the ideology itself. No one wanted to talk about it. Not only the Pentagon refused to acknowledge the study, but actually the second in command at the Pentagon, who happened to be a Muslim and a Muslim Brotherhood agent, ended up firing Steve Coughlin, the guy
Wow.
who worked on the study, and kicking him out of the Pentagon. And so we went through a period in the United States, especially under Obama, where nobody wanted to listen to what we were trying to say because the Islamists, aided and abetted by the liberal Jewish community in the United States, which
True.
is 80% liberal, are the ones who worked with the Islamic community, which I call they were the useful idiots, who worked with the Islamic community in standing up against Islamophobia. Their heart was in the right place, but they were so misguided and so ill-informed. And that's how we end up with the situation that we are in today.
Yeah, well, in speaking about some of those liberal, lobotomized, progressive Jews, I tell a story in The Parasitic Mind, in this book, in the yellow one, where a Jewish woman, a friend from Montreal, had approached me. This is probably 2010, maybe. And she said, oh, I have a friend of mine who's doing her PhD in Islamic studies. And she insists that, you know, Islam is the religion of peace and all this stuff. So can you, Gad, you know your stuff about Islam. You come from that world. Can you tell me what is the real position? Does Islam love the Jews or not? And so on. So I sent her, Brigitte, a montage. You may have seen it. It's about a 20-minute montage of imams, kids, teachers in the Islamic world saying some of the most diabolical things about the Jews. Like, it makes the Nazis seem as though they are warm and fuzzy. At the end of which, when I send her that clip, her response is, you're no different in your extremism than them. So let's break it down. So her asking me and she's Jewish, by the way, and her grandparents went through the Holocaust. So her asking me, tell me about the position of Islam on Jews, and I share with her veridical, accurate information. Her conclusion is, I am the extremist for spreading that stuff. About 2 months ago, she sends me an email. We hadn't spoken for many years because, as you might imagine, I was not pleased with her reaction. We hadn't spoken for over a decade. She sends me an email and she basically says, oops, I should have listened to you all those years ago. So you're exactly right that, again, many of the ostriches who bury their head in the sand are the ones who should be awakened. They're called Jews, but they too are lobotomized. And so that's why sometimes I feel as though it's a lost cause. I want to be optimistic. I get up every morning wanting to fight, but the imbecility is unbelievable, Brigitte.
It is unbelievable, but we have to continue fighting. In my case, I created an organization called Act for America because I wanted to make sure I not only educate, education is important, but I learned very early on, we can educate until the cows come home. Nothing is going to change. Education is important, but education by itself is insufficient. Education must be coupled with action. So I started Act for America to mobilize and organize people in their own community to start working on issues that will impact policy. And I'm proud to tell you that Act for America today is 2.8 million members. We have helped pass 240 bills on the federal level and the state level to protect America. Right now, we are working on many bills in Congress to expel any foreign student on a student visa in the United States who have been caught participating in these rallies, kick their behind out of the United States. They have no business being here. We are working on, for example, putting a cap on funding for any university that's accepting funds from overseas in any Arabic countries. Limit the number of foreign students that are allowed to be accepted into our major universities. We are working on so many bills in Congress, and this is what I started doing. So I encourage people, if you are listening to us right now from anywhere in the country or the world, go to actforamerica.org, actforamerica.org right now. Sign up to get our emails and action alerts. Stand with us and support our work. We need you engaged. We need you involved. The only way we're going to be able to impact policy and change the world, not by just sitting and being entertained, getting educated by actually by being organized and mobilized in a way that can impact policy to have a positive outcome for world peace and national security.
Well, by the way, the organization that you started speaks to something that I often talk about when I ask people to activate their inner honey badger. Where I'm saying there is, you don't have to already have a big platform. When you started, you weren't a famous politician or you were just someone who had the truth on your side. You had the personality and temperament to get engaged, and you went from having zero platform to 2.8 million. That to me is a very empowering message, because I get tons of people who write to me and say, yeah, but I'm not some famous professor who's got the ear of Joe Rogan or whatever. How do you expect me to affect any change? Well, my answer should be, go look at what Brigitte Gabriel has done, right? Because you didn't start with anything.
That's right, exactly. You know, when I started after 9/11, well, here's how I started ACT for America. I told you when I was in Lebanon and my house was bombed. When I was wounded in the hospital, I spent 2.5 months in the hospital, going from one surgery to another, hooked up to IVs, and I would ask my father, why did they do this to us? And my father would tell me, they consider us infidels and they want to kill us. So I learned since I was a 10-year-old little girl that I am wanted dead simply because I was born into the Christian faith and lived in a Christian town. On 9/11/2001, my two young daughters came home from school, and they didn't tell them at school what had happened. So they came home at a normal hour. And, you know, 9/11 was a defining moment for the United States. 9/11 changed the way we live, changed the way we bank, changed the way we all bank anywhere in the world, changed the way we listen to the news. On 9/11/2001, no matter where you were in the world, if you were next to a television TV set, you were parked in front of that TV set, we couldn't get enough news. My two daughters came home from school that day, and my youngest daughter was watching television with me, seeing the images of the World Trade Center come down again and again and again being replayed. And she said to me, she said, "Mommy, why did they do this to us?" And I found myself, God, looking at my daughter's eyes and repeating to her the exact same words my father said to me. They hate us because they consider us infidels and they want to kill us. Here we were, two generations apart. I was a young Lebanese girl. She's a young American girl. I spoke Arabic. She spoke English. 8,000 miles apart, two continents apart, 30 years apart. And I had to repeat to my daughter the same words my father said to me. That day, I vowed that I will do everything I can to make sure that my daughter will never, ever look into her child's eyes and repeat to him or to her what my daddy said to me and what I had to say to her. That day, I was reborn as an activist. 9/11 happened on a Tuesday morning. I laid in my pajamas on the couch in my family room from Tuesday morning until Sunday, thinking, what can I do to make a difference? You see, God, I'm a firm believer that every single one of us in life, no matter what trials and tribulations we go through, no matter what challenges we go through, everything in life happens for a reason. All these challenges, they are nothing more but a sharpening tool to make us become who we are today, to serve a purpose, to make the world a better place. I believe every single one of us has a destiny and has a purpose. I am so grateful that I found my purpose at a young age on 9/11. And I realized I now understand why I went through war, why I became a news anchor, how I can talk to the press in sound bites. I'm fluent in four languages. I can make a difference. I'm a Middle Eastern woman. Arabic is my mother tongue. I look Middle Eastern. I can have an impact. I want to make a difference for my country, the United States of America. And I knew I didn't know anything about nonprofits. I didn't know anything about how to set up a nonprofit or how to get it going, but I had determination. So once I decided I'm going to start an organization that's going to mobilize American and educate Americans about the threat of radical Islam to world peace and national security, I remember turning my guest room into an office. And I went to Office Depot and I bought one of those cheap desks for $150 that took 3 days to put together. It was so heavy. Carried it upstairs to my office, to the guest room, and I printed business cards, 1,000 business cards for 10 bucks at Office Max. And I remember the address was 2420 Litchfield Way, Suite 201, which meant you go upstairs, first room on the right, and that was my address. And those are the cards that I would hand out. I had determination. And that's why on my website, Brigitte Gabrielle, I say, 2% of the passionate will always overrule the 98% indifferent. It doesn't take money to change the world. It only takes a dedicated few. And that's people like you and me and our listeners, whom I hope you are today listening to me. Because if you are right here listening right now, you are here for a reason. You are here for a purpose. This was Bisharet for the Jewish listeners. And for the non-Jewish listeners, you are here for a reason. Every single one of us can make a difference. Every single one of us. Today, I reach 8 million people a day on my social media platforms. I have 2.8 million members. I have 500,000 activists throughout the United States. We have activists, my organization, on the ground in 3,070 counties out of 3,143 counties nationwide in America. We cover 97% of U.S. territories. And we helped pass 250 bills in Congress as well as on the state level to protect America, to impact terrorism laws, to stand with Israel, our ally, to make sure America is safe and secure. If I can do it, you can do it.
Allah ya'tiki al-afya. I'm getting tired just hearing about your energy. My goodness, I need a nap.
Thank you. Well, you know, cooped up in a bomb shelter for 7 years, you know.
You had a lot of energy. Do you have a strategy in terms of how to reach the people? So, for example, earlier today I appeared on Charlie Kirk's show. You know who Charlie Kirk is, right?
Yeah, of course.
So his strategy is, you know, he decided that the university ecosystem is where he needs to be, because that's where, to the point of The Parasitic Mind, my book, all of these bad ideas, they're always spawned on university campuses and then they spread out to the rest of society. So do you have a sort of meta strategy of where you want to go, or you'll go wherever there is minds that need to be changed?
I started the organization in 2002, right after 9/11. And my goal was to mobilize people and train them in their activism to have an impact on our national policy to protect America. So what we went, because not only we knew that the education is happening in the school system, and not just on college campuses, but it started with sixth grade all the way up through college. So we focused on the education back at the elementary and middle school and high school, because we knew that's where the brainwashing is happening. But at the same time, we realized, and when you have a sinking boat, yes, you can patch immediately where the hole is, but you have to have a long-term strategy. And our strategy was, we cannot just depend on students to change the world. A 21-year-old kid is not interested in running for school board. School board is a nothing position. It's a public service position, but it's not important. We realized a 20-year-old is not interested in running for city council. City council, I mean, what's a city council? It's a nothing position. And so, but those are the positions that make an impact. It's the local school board. It's the local school board that decide what books your children study at school. It is the local city council that decides to defund the police. It's the local mayor that decides to tell the police to stand down. It's the local state delegates that decide Dominion voting machines in your state. So we went after those type of position to try to flip community on the political level, because we've got a nation to save. Yes, we can wait for the students until they are married in their 30s and they have kids where they actually develop, okay, I need to serve my community. But then we went immediately after my work focused on the people who actually sit on the members of the Chamber of Commerce. They sit on boards in their community, whether it's a business board, they own their own businesses. They have a vested interest, either their business, their life, their families, their job, or their children, to protect the nation. And that's how we were able to grow the way we grew. You know, they say an overnight success takes 20 years. You know, people see you all of a sudden successful with a massive operation, with a massive national operation, bills passed, relationship with the White House and in Congress, and they go, oh, she's so lucky. You know, it's amazing. She's so successful. They don't realize that I started in my guest bedroom with a $150 desk, because at that time, that's all I could afford because the economy collapsed. We lost all our money. But I had determination, and it took me 22 years of sleepless nights, heart sweat, building the organization block by block. And all of a sudden now people look around and say, wow, how did you do that? That's what it takes. It's never too late to start, but we've got to start somewhere.
Now, I probably know the answer to what I'm about to ask, but because you already wield a lot of influence through your grassroots activism. But do you ever consider the possibility of you running for political office, because that might allow you to have a more, you know, a quicker turnaround and being able to implement things? Or do you feel that the current situation is one that allows you to change a lot more minds than you would otherwise within the confined ecosystem of politics?
I will never run for a political office, and here is why. If I run for a political office and I get elected, I am only one vote. Right now, I influence every single member of Congress. That's how we are able to pass these bills. We created a tool called Act Now Campaign. We monitor all bills coming down for a vote on the federal level in Congress as well as on the state level. I have a team that goes through these bills. We identify the bills we want to get behind. Then we send an Act Now campaign, an email to our members, and we say this bill number HR 750 coming down for a vote just got introduced in Congress. You call your elected officials, and we send this email nationwide. So we get people from every single state in the union to put pressure on their elected official to either co-sponsor or vote yes on that bill. So my activism can influence 200 members of Congress and their votes instead of me being one vote. We influence presidential elections, we influence local elections. And look, I started my organization. George Bush was in office. George Bush came and left. Obama became president. Obama came and left. Trump became president. Trump came and left. Biden is president. Biden is going to leave. I'm still here. I am already ahead 250 bills. And no matter who's going to come, who's going to go, we are here and we are growing and we are impacting policy.
Is Biden leaving now, or are we going to have to suffer another 4 years? Please, Brigitte, give us the good news.
We are trying our darndest to make sure that the senile president of the United States, who has no idea what's happening in the country because he is not running the country, but the deep state and the members who are pulling him on a string are running the country. We are trying to do everything we can in our power to make sure we fix our broken election process to ensure that the rightful, successful candidate who actually wins the election will sit at the White House for the next 5 years instead of somebody who may cheat in order to sit at the White House for the next 5 years or 4 years.
4 years, inshallah. All right. Can you give us a list, other than, of course, signing up for your important newsletters and so on? You know, here is a recipe of four things that the average person listening to this conversation could go out and do in the next few days so that they at least can feel that they've contributed. Can you give us a bit of a plan of what everybody can do?
What the first thing that everybody can do is become engaged in a local political grassroots organization, because I know we have a lot of people listening to us in Canada right now and different parts of the world. I'm not just talking to a US audience. No matter what country you are in, immediately you need to be plugged in with passionate people who are working to impact policy in your community, whatever group it is. Second, you need to be engaged in the political process, and that is by volunteering with a political organization that bodifies the views that you agree with, your views, your values, your free speech, your wanting to preserve Western nations, you wanting to preserve our freedom. What made Western civilizations great? The freedoms that we have. You need to immediately be plugged into these types of people. Support and show up and volunteer to those organizations. They need volunteers like you, and they need supporters like you, financial supporters. If you are busy and you are unable to give up your time, do not underestimate the power of your donation. Whether it's $5, whether it's $10, whether it's $100,000. Because people who are leading grassroots organizations in your nation, in your community, cannot operate without funding from the grassroots. For example, we don't receive any governmental funding. We do not receive any government grants because we do not want to be muzzled. We rely on the donations of great people like you right now watching us in order to operate and we grow. And because I'm speaking to an international audience, whatever country you are from right now, whatever organization you decide to be involved with in your own community, If you are unable to give of your time, make sure you support them financially. They need you. In our case, we are a nonprofit organization, a 501c3, so your donation is tax deductible. I know there's a lot of people listening who go between America and Canada. If you are in a position to support our work, I would be so grateful. But we are fighting to preserve our values. And, you know, if you are interested in starting a sister organization, any like us, anywhere in the world, start one. You know, we used to have Act for Canada. I think our chapter leader is retiring. So maybe you should start an Act for Canada. I know there is Action for Canada. You can join as well. There are many ways for people to support and contribute.
Wonderful. Are there any projects that you're currently working on that you might want to use this platform to promote? It could be a next book you're working on, a new endeavor. Tell us what's going to be keeping Brigitte busy for the next year or two.
What's keeping Brigitte busy is the United States election this year, wanting to make sure that we have the right people in office and also making sure we are safe and secure. Right now, we have many bills in Congress that supports law enforcement and gives the power to law enforcement. This is why we are working so hard on the mayoral races, on the local races, but also on bills in Congress that will make sure we'll penalize students who are using the democracy, the open-mindedness of the West to basically create a third world country structure like the countries they left and they came here. Look, they are in America or in Canada because they cannot do in Saudi Arabia what they are doing in America and in Canada. They cannot do in Jordan what they are doing in America and in Canada. You know, in Jordan, the king's stepbrother is in jail because the king threw his stepbrother in jail because his stepbrother was arguing with him about power. There was a power struggle. We are a nation where all people from the Middle East, from these third world countries come to because they love our freedom. And we need to stand up and protect our freedom. Welcoming them into our country does not give them the right to destroy our country, to destroy our national monuments, to destroy our universities, to destroy the peace in our country. We have a right to live in peace and security in our own nations. And any guest who comes to our nation, they need to abide by our laws. So our number one thing right now is we are working with on many bills with Congress. So I encourage you to sign up to get our emails and action alerts. They're free. They don't cost you anything. Go to actforamerica.org right now. Sign up to receive our emails and action alert. And if you have a dual citizenship, an American Canadian citizenship, you can take action about the bills being introduced in Congress. So we want to empower you. We want your voice heard. So please stand with us. Go to actforamerica.org right now.
I'm going to say something in Arabic, then I'll try to translate it as we close out this conversation. Brigitte, عن جد ما بنشبع منك.
أوه شكرا كتير مش معقول شكرا شكرا جزيلا إن شاء الله يا رب نلتقي مع بعضنا وجها لوجه مثل ما بيقولوا
إن شاء الله. I said to Brigitte, you know, Arabic is a very beautiful language. It has very sort of flowery intonation to it. So one of the things that you tell someone when you're saying goodbye, it is impossible to be satiated of you. Maybe شبع منك. That means that just like when you eat, imagine you can eat and you could never get full. This is how you tell someone when you are enjoying so much the conversation. Brigitte, thank you so much for coming. I hope this will be the first of many future conversations. I look forward to seeing you in person. You are a hero. Keep fighting. Stay on the line so we could say goodbye offline.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. It was fantastic.
Thank you for having me with you.
Cheers.